thanks for coming. For those members who will not have to be reminded to come and do their responsibility. Today, we were supposed to take the last three presenters on the, that is the submissions. So they indicated late on Thursday that they would like to send written submissions instead of oral submissions. As a result of that, then we decided that today we are going to start with the deliberations on the bill. And tomorrow, it will depend on how fast we go. And those who were part of the meeting when Bob Crewe was making a presentation, I have decided to start with an investigation on those allegations. And secondly, I have also decided that during the process, we have to call the police, that is the management of the police. They'll have to respond to some of the issues that have been raised there, firstly. And secondly, we're going to call the management of the police again. And before we pass this bill, we want to be 100% sure whether they do have a capacity to implement this. Experience has shown us that we pass good bills as Parliament, but at the end of the day, they are not being implemented because of lack of capacity. So these are some of the things that before we can even consider passing this bill, we'll have to be told and be convinced that members of SAP will be able to implement this. And then before, after saying that, I think then we can ask then the department to take us through clause by clause. We'll see how far we go, but at least by 12 o'clock we needed to be out of this place, and then we'll start again tomorrow morning up to 12 o'clock, because I think members of parliament would like to be part of the processes in the house. Hence I have decided that we'll be here up to 12 o'clock. I don't know who is it from the department that's going to take us through. Okay, you will take us through then. Thanks for this document that you said that you have summarized all the comments of the people here. We also from our side then did ask our own people that they must do the same as what you did. So I will compare the two and see whether everything has been captured that has been said. The things that are going to be helpful to us as the portfolio committee. Over to you then.
Thank you, Chairperson. So if I understand you correctly, we're not going to refer to the comments today. If I go clause by clause, I just go clause by clause. So if I could start then with clause 2. Clause 2 is an amendment to the heading of Chapter 3 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Currently, Chapter 3 only refers to the... it refers to... only accused persons, and we've broadened the definition to now refer to the ascertainment of bodily features of persons, because we've made consequential amendments within this chapter that deals with the collection of all bodily features, so the fingerprints, the DNA of accused and convicted. So the heading couldn't just refer to accused anymore, so it's really just a consequential amendment which came as a result of what we added into Chapter 3. Then Clause 2 deals with the insertion of Section 36A, 36B, and 36C in Chapter 3 of the Criminal Procedure Act. The Criminal Procedure Act at this moment, Chapter 3, only had one section, and that was Section 37, and that's the outdated clause that we're trying to update with this legislation to increase our fingerprints and DNA capacity. The first clause then, or the first section that we're inserting is in the interpretation of Chapter 3, which is the definitions clause. Chapter 3 never had a definitions clause before, and that is Section 63A. If I could start in with the definitions one by one. The first one is authorized person, and here we differentiate between authorized persons for the purposes of photographic images, fingerprints, or body prints, and authorized persons when we talk about DNA. For the first category, which the police are already using in their investigative, as part of their investigation, we say that it's any police official in the performance of his or her official duties. So it's limited in that sense. Then with regard to the NDAs, an authorized person in this bill would be the police officer commanding the Division Criminal Record and Forensic Science Service within the South African Police Service or his or her delegate. So we're trying to limit access to the national database of South Africa to the forensic experts within the CRC and FSS. Authorized person should be read in conjunction with the definition for speculative search, which follows at the bottom, and so I'm going to skip to speculative search. Speculative search is what's used throughout the bill in order to either identify a person according to his fingerprints by linking, in this bill we're linking the APIS system of the police to harness and to the innate system of the Department of Transport. So that's why in sub AI, before I read the definition, we're dealing specifically with fingerprints and photographic images and body prints. And it's in this sense that the authorized person will then only be those members of the police that would do this in the performance of his or her official duties as part of an investigation. While in sub 2, we deal with the DNA database, and there we have a limit accessing only to the authorized persons within that specific forensic science unit. Speculative search means the body prints, fingerprints, photographic images, intimate samples or non-intimate samples, or the information derived from such samples taken. That information derived from such samples taken in each instance refer to the DNA profile of the person that you developed from the sample. Taken under any power confirmed by this chapter, may for purposes related to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offence, or the conduct of a prosecution, be checked by an authorised person against them in the first instance. In the case of photographic images, body prints or fingerprints, the databases of the South African Police Service, the Department of Home Affairs, the Department of Transport, or any department of state in the national, provincial, or local sphere of government, irrespective of whether the photographic images or prints stored in this respective databases were collected before or after coming into operation of this Act. We specifically wrote in that last part, the police, of course, already have fingerprints and photographic images, so we didn't want to now exclude those and have them just focus on the new ones that they will be loading, so it's a retrospective to include all of that. And whilst we refer here also to databases in other departments of state, the national, provincial and local sphere, the police have explained to me that sometimes they might know that there's a database within the Department of Education in the Western Cape and they're investigating an offence and they would like to then access that database. So it's also within state, the government sphere. And then speculative search with regard to DNA, in the case of intimate samples or non-intimate samples or the information derived from such samples, the NDDSA, and the NDDSA in itself is defined as the database, a national DNA database of South Africa, which is established in terms of Section 15F of the South African Police Service Act. So speculative search you will see references to throughout the bill, and then we will come to that when I go clause by clause, but that is literally where we try to identify the perpetrator. So we find DNA on the crime scene, we develop a DNA profile, and we've got this database, and then we run this profile against the database, and the speculative search allows us to do that. And then the same with fingerprints, we find the fingerprints on a crime scene, and now instead of just running it against the police's database of fingerprints, we can run it against our affairs, innate and the like. So this is a very important provision, this definition, and then the provisions that refer to it further on in the bill. If we return then to the alphabetical order of the definition, body prints means prints taken from a person's ear, foot, nose, palm, or toes. Body prints is again referred to in Section 37 of the bill. We've inserted this new definition. In the past, the police only had Section 37 only referred to fingerprints, palm prints, and footprints. And the police came and said, well, they've also got these prints that they can take. These are not offensive or invasive procedures. They're from the ear, the nose, or the toes. They sometimes find toe prints on a crime scene. This allows them to then take these in terms of Section 37. So that's why this definition was inserted, and it's limited to these specific body parts. The police wanted, and the NPA, the NPA and some of the other commentators when it comes to the submissions later on, actually wanted to broaden this to include any other body part. But if you look at Section 37, it allows the police to take body prints, and we can't have the police taking buttock print, for instance, or whichever other body part. So we try and limit it to these specific instances of ear, foot, nose, palm, and toes. Then we've got a definition of child, which means a person under the age of 18 years. Why is he on there?
I'm sorry about that, guys, because I forget that. Then you talk that you've limited the police. That is the palm, the fingerprints, and everything. There was an example which was made when we were in Pretoria. I've seen on when they say that, take for instance, you get to a crime scene, and then you come across an iPhone, which has been good. By the iPhone and throw it there. And then that means the leaves and the teeth, you know? You're looking at that. Are the police then allowed to?
That is from the crime scene. They can analyze all of that, and they can, if they want to do the dental records, they will have to refer to a medical practitioner. And we've now, if they found the apple now and they found a suspect and they want to compare the dental records, they can't take the dental impression themselves, but they will take it to a medical practitioner. We've now actually strengthened their powers there with Statement 37. That medical practitioner must deal with the evidence. They can't refuse to assist the police, so if we don't. No, that's all included. It's just what the police can personally take. We don't want the police to personally start doing the procedure. That should be done by a medical professional. Then, as I said, what's the definition of child? DNA means deoxyribonucleic acid, which I would leave over to the police to pronounce. Then we have DNA analysis, means analysis of this acid. Identification information in an intimate sample, a non-intimate sample, or any other bodily substance. In this bill, we deal with all these definitions. An intimate sample is defined just below. It means a sample of blood other than a blood finger prick. So it would be taken from the vein. It would be done by a medical professional if we go further in the bill. Intimate samples cannot be taken by the police. Non-intimate samples, on the other hand, means a sample of hair other than pubic hair, so it could be one strand of hair with the root attached to it, a sample taken from underneath the nail or from a nail or underneath a nail, a swab taken from the mouth, which is that instrument that looks like an ear, that you would clean your ears with, you would swab in the mouth, but against the side of the mouth so you can get the cells, a blood finger prick, and the members have seen how easily that's done on the Honourable John, when we were there in the land, or a combination of these. Then that definition of DNA analysis also refers to any other bodily substance. Those bodily substances would be the ones you find on the crime scene. So they are not being collected by anybody from a person. They would be found on a crime scene, and it's from there that you derive the DNA profile to load on the crime scene index that we'll come to just now. Then we have the definition of the NDDSA, as I've already dealt with, and that would be basically a summary of the definitions. And then subclause 2 of section 36A just says, for the purposes of this chapter, unless the context indicates otherwise, any reference to a person includes a child. I could maybe mention here that the police, and this was not in formal submissions, but in discussions with Divisional Commissioner or Acting Divisional Commissioner Haldenheid, they requested us to remove this reference to child because they said in the CPA, the Criminal Procedure Act, children are already included in the reference to person in any case, so it's just confused the matter. So we have no problem with that if we come to that later on if we go with possible amendments. Then section 36B, the following section, which is a very important section, we've received a lot of comments on this section. Powers in respect of fingerprints and non-intimate samples of accused and convicted persons. This is where we want to make the taking of fingerprints from these categories of people compulsory. We're currently in May under 37, so we want to build up this extensive data, our fingerprint database. And this is also the section that the police will now use to take non-intimate samples, that buccal swab or the fingerprint, to populate the DNA database for the first time in South Africa. So the first subsection 1, then there's an A and a B section. The A deals specifically with fingerprints, and the B section deals with the taking of the non-intimate sample. A police official must take the fingerprints or must cause such fingerprints to be taken of any person arrested upon any charge. Person released on bail or warning under section 72, such person's fingerprints were not taken upon arrest. Romans 3, person upon whom a summons has been served in respect of any offence referred to in Schedule 1, Schedule 1 is really a series of offences in the CPA, or any offence with reference to which the suspension, cancellation, or endorsement of any license or permit, or the disqualification in respect of any license or permit is permissible or prescribed. In subsection 4, a person convicted by a court and sentenced to a term of imprisonment, whether suspended or not, or any non-custodial sentence. And then there's a typo there. It should read, if fingerprints were not taken upon arrest, because this first sub-A deals with fingerprints. Then sub 5, from the police can take fingerprints, must take fingerprints from a person convicted by a court in respect of any offence, which the minister has by notice in the Gazette declared to be an offence for the purposes of this sub-paragraph. The difference between Romans 4 and 5 we will come to when we deal with the submissions. We actually have a proposal there. We want to change the wording a bit to make it clear. But sub 5 would be that the minister would identify specific offences for which the fingerprints should be taken, and sub 4 should deal with anybody who's been sentenced to a term of imprisonment or but we will come to that when we deal with the submissions. Then Romans 6 refers to a person deemed under section 57.6 to have been convicted in respect of any offence which the minister has by notice in the Gazette declared to be an offence for the purposes of this subparagraph. This just refers to admission of guilt fines. So the minister can make a list in the Gazette saying, if you've paid admission of guilt fine for something serious, then we want you to, or the minister can use his own criteria or her own criteria, but just to get admission of guilt fines into the spectrum as well. I can mention that all six of these categories basically come word for word from the existing section 37, where it's just not compulsory to take them. We've just made it broadened, especially around the convicted offenders. We've expanded this, but otherwise it's existing provisions. Then exactly the same category of persons are listed in sub B, from which a non-intimate sample must be taken by the police. Then subsection 2, just make provision to clearly state what should happen to these fingerprints. We want to be clear that fingerprints taken in terms of subsection 1A must be stored on the fingerprint database maintained by the South African Police Service in terms of chapter 5A, which is the chapter we're inserting when we come to the SAPS Act, the first chapter. And then we want the non-intimate sample to be handed over to the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service, or he's a delegate, who shall carry out the DNA analysis on these non-intimate samples and then load it onto the National DNA Database under Chapter 5, which we'll come to in the back. So it's clear if you've taken the fingerprints, if you've taken the non-intimate sample, where must it go? It must go to this specific unit within the police service to be administered there. Then subsection 3 deals with makes provision that the police can retake fingerprints if the fingerprints taken on the previous occasion did not constitute a complete set of fingerprints. To run the APIS system, you need a complete set of 10 fingerprints to be loaded on there. If you then find a partial print on a crime scene, you can easily run it to ensure that the police have a perfect set of 10 fingers. Or some of all the fingerprints taken on the previous occasion are not sufficient quality to allow it. So it's basically a quality control provision, subsection 3, to ensure the quality of the prints taken under 1A. Then the same applies to the taking of the non-intimate sample. Subsection 4 just provides that the police may retake a non-intimate sample if the non-intimate sample taken on this occasion was not suitable or insufficient for DNA analysis. Then subsection 5, the fingerprints non-intimate samples for the information derived from such samples, which I've explained as the DNA profile, taken under any power confirmed in this section, may be subject to a speculated search. That is then when the definition of speculated search kicks in, so we now know that it means that you can run the fingerprints against the databases of Varnet or eNATIS, or that you can run the DNA profile against the NDDSA. Then subsection 6, deals with, yes, subsection 6A is the section where we want to retain the DNA profile. Subsection, subject to paragraph B and the fingerprints, the fingerprints, non-intimate samples, or the information derived from non-intimate samples, or from such samples, taken under any power conferred by this section, must be retained after it has fulfilled the purposes for which it was taken or analyzed, but shall only be used for purposes related to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offence, or the conduct of a prosecution. This section is specifically then there to address the lacuna in the current section 37, where we have to destroy everything if a person was found not guilty. So we want to retain at this stage, the legislation asks for the retention of the fingerprints, the non-intimate samples, and the DNA profile, but we can discuss this matter in more detail later. Then subsection B says nothing in paragraph A shall prohibit the use by the police officer commanding the division CRC and FSS within the SAPS or his or her delegates of any fingerprints taken under any powers conferred by this section for the purposes of establishing if a person has been convicted of an offence. We're creating an offence in this section if you use the prints or the non-intimate samples or the DNA profile for any other purpose than those specifically stated legitimate government purposes of detection of crime, investigation of offence, or the conduct of the prosecution. So the police came and said, well, we also do these checks for previous criminal records, and if you want to go overseas and you want passports, you must check against the date. But so we just wanted to be sure that they're not criminalized if they do that. So that's what subsection B does. Then subsection C, any person who uses or allows the use of fingerprints, non-intimate samples, or the information derived from such sample for any purpose not related to the detection of crime, investigation of offence, or the conduct of the prosecution is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 15 years. This is then where we build in, this is one of the safeguards built into the legislation. Not only may you use these this real evidence is your prints or DNA evidence, only for the specific government purposes, but you might, if you do anything outside these perimeters, it's an offence and you can face a penalty of up to 15 years or a fine. Then subsection 7 should be read in conjunction with Roman 4 of subsection 1, which deals with convicted offenders, and it's in subsection 7 that we're trying to make it retrospective. We're saying if you've been convicted of a sentence if you're convicted of those specific sentences provided for in those subsections, then we give the police the power to retrospectively collect DNA and fingerprints from you. This provision has been taken from the Canadian legislation. It was challenged there, and you know they've got a constitution very similar to ours, and it was found to be constitutional. In accordance with their charter, I could read to you the reference to that case when we deal maybe clause by clause again. Then subsection 8, this is what was inserted by the state law advisors that the deputy minister referred to in his when he briefed the committee on this legislation the first time, and we would like to remove this section. This is where, because we would like to retain the fingerprints, non-intimate samples, or the DNA profile of persons who are not convicted by courts. As we've said before, fingerprints, in any case, your fingerprints, if we're now linking fingerprints with harness, we've got your fingerprints there, so now why should we delete it if you're not found guilty? We want to keep the fingerprints. And it's for the purpose of expanding the fingerprint database, and there will only be a hit against your fingerprints was found on a crime scene, and then the normal investigation will kick in, and you will be presumed innocent until found guilty in a court of law. The same with the DNA. On the DNA, however, there is a distinction between the sample and the DNA profile. And the department, in conjunction with the police service, has no problem at this stage not to retain the sample. So we can amend the legislation if the committee decides to deliberate in that direction, whatever policy guidance or policy decisions the committee take. We're not bound to keeping the sample. So it's the sample that you can analyze, and the sample contains your whole gene makeup. But the DNA profile is only a sequence of numbers, and that's what we would like to keep, and we would urge the committee to seriously consider that we can then remove subsection 8, so that we can keep that DNA profile indefinitely. As we've shown in submissions that was made to this committee, a DNA database is only really effective if we've got a large reference index to run a DNA profile that we found at a crime scene against. And if we don't retain the sample, DNA profile, all this legislation might not even have a great impact on our DNA investigative capabilities in the future. Having said that, then we can move on to section 36C, which deals with body prints and samples for investigation purposes. this section was specifically inserted after deliberations with the police, have requested the section to this effect. If you turn to the back of the bill, page 19 as well as page 21, this section is modeled very closely on the existing legislation, the Firearms Control Act, section 113, and section 9 of the Explosives Act. One is a 2000 piece of legislation and one is a 2003 piece of legislation. And those sections were put into that legislation to give the police the power as an investigative tool where they have a reasonable reasonable grounds to suspect that a person has committed an offence and a reasonable grounds to believe that the prints or samples to be taken under these powers will be linked, will assist them in the investigation. Then they've inserted it into those pieces of legislation. They've now asked us to do the same here. So what this section does is say any police official may, without a warrant, take fingerprints, body prints, and non-intimate samples of a person or a group of persons if there are reasonable grounds to firstly suspect that that person or more than one person in that group has committed an offence, and secondly, reasonable grounds to believe that that those prints and samples, or the results of the examination thereof, which would mean the DNA profile, will be of value in the investigation by excluding or including one or more persons as possible perpetrators of the offence. So this is really an investigation. This is a tool that was inserted here. As the subsection 2 continues by saying, the person who has control over prints or samples taken in terms of this section may examine them for purposes of the investigation of the relevant offence or cause them to be so examined. You may ask, who is this person? If you read down, you would also see the similar provisions that we put in 36B. Been inserted here, it would be the Division Criminal Records Forensic Science Services for fingerprints and body prints. In sub C, there's the reference, and in sub D, there's the reference of any non-intimate samples taken under subsection 1 must be handed over to that division again to be dealt with in the National DNA Database. Subsection 2, so those are the persons we're referring to there. And then subsection 2 also allows that person then to call such prints non-intimate samples or information derived from such samples to be subjected to a speculated search. So it's basically the same principle as set out in 36B, it's just for these specific categories where the police have, they must prove that they've got reasonable grounds to suspect an offence and reasonable grounds that the prints taken or samples will actually be of value in that investigation. Then exactly the same provisions are set out here that you can only use it for these specific purposes. If you use it for any other purpose, you're liable to conviction of up to 15 years. And then again, there's the sub 4 on page 6, on the top of page 6, which was inserted by the state law advisors, which we again like to remove as to the previous argument that I made. It's just they've added in everywhere where we said we wanted to retain, they said no, only for 5 years. Now we're saying, well, we're okay if we delete the sample, but we want to keep the DNA profile indefinitely. So it's only a sequence of numbers that can really assist in the investigation. Then if we come to section 37, which is the only existing section in chapter 3 on the ascertainment of bodily features in the Criminal Procedure Act. Here we have clause 3, which amends section 37. And what we're doing here is we're also including convicted persons specifically in the section. The section did previously refer to convicted persons, but the minister had to publish a list in the Government Gazette, and this has never actually happened since 1977. This is where the police may take, and it's a typographical error, fingerprints were supposed to be included here, but we can debate that when we come to the submission. But any police official may take the fingerprints or a body print or may cause such prints to be taken, and then it's the same list of persons that we've listed in 36A, in 36B. The power here is where, as far as the investigation and police official see it is necessary to take these prints, then he has the power to do so. So it's not compulsory if it seems that it will be applicable in the specific investigation. Then any police official may make the person referred to in paragraph AI or paragraph A, and then it refers to the sections in 36B where it's compulsory to take fingerprints or non-intimate samples from these categories. available or cause such person to be made available for identification in such condition, position or peril as the police may determine. This is the existing subsection B that deals with identity for rape. And we've basically not amended anything here except inserted a reference to those categories where we're taking compulsory fingerprints or samples. So it's the existing position. Subsection C was only also inserted references to subsections A and B of the compulsory taking, and we've changed, removed the word blood sample and inserted intimate sample in line with the definitions clause. And this is the section, this subsection C is the existing law. This is where the police want to establish whether a person's body, an accused body, has any marked characteristic or distinguishing feature or shows any condition or appearance. The police can then examine the body, but a male can only, or a female can only examine a female. This would have been the situation where a person's got a tattoo, for instance. So this is the existing situation and law. Then 371D deals with the taking of photographs. Here we've just broadened the wording. Instead of just referring to photograph, we've said photographic image. So this can now include your digital photos, for instance. If that doesn't matter, the court questions whether it's a photograph, it's a photographic image. So it's just to update the legislation with the advancement in technology in this field, this legislation, as you know, Chair, dates back to 1977. And then again, we refer to the categories in 36B1A, I or II. So we're saying that if the police feels that it's necessary to also take a photo of those persons, that they take the compulsory fingerprint or intimate sample, non-intimate sample from under 36B, they can do it with this power. Then subsection 2 deals with the medical officers. This is also the existing position. What we've changed here is it used to say any medical officer of any prison or any district surgeon, or if requested there by any police official, any registered medical practitioner or registered nurse may. We said must take steps, including an intimate sample as may be deemed necessary in order to ascertain whether the body of any person referred to in paragraph, it's the persons listed in I, Roman 1 to 2, or subsection 1, or paragraph Roman 1, 2, those are again the compulsory categories, has any marked characteristic or distinguishing feature or shows any condition or appearance. We've inserted must here to ensure that we do not run into a situation where the medical practitioner might refuse to assist the police in conducting this investigation, but it's the existing position in law, apart from changing to must. Then subsection 2B, if any registered medical practitioner attached to any hospital is unreasonable grounds of opinion that the condition, that the contents of an intimate sample of any person admitted to such a hospital for medical attention or treatment may be relevant at any later criminal proceedings, such medical practitioner may take an intimate sample of such person or cause such sample to be taken, provided that such sample must be taken if requested by a police official. This is also the existing position in law. If a person is admitted to an hospital, he smells of alcohol, was involved in an accident, the medical practitioner will take a blood sample for later use in court. We've just now said that if the police ask that medical practitioner to do so, he cannot refuse. Then subsection 3, any court before which, so basically the structure of section 37 is that first deals in subsection 1 with the powers of the police, and then in subsection 2 it deals with the powers of the medical officer that comes into contact with an accused, and then subsection 3 deals specifically with where it's the court who asks for additional tests to be done or prints to be taken or appearances to be examined. So subsection 3 says any court before which criminal proceedings are pending may, in any case in which a police official is not empowered under subsection 1 or section 36B1 to take fingerprints, body prints, or a non-intimate sample, or to take steps in order to ascertain whether the body of any person has any marked characteristic or distinguishing feature or shows any condition or appearance, order that such prints be taken of any accused at such proceedings, or that the steps, including the taking of an intimate sample, be taken which such courts may deem necessary in order to ascertain whether the body of the accused
as any such mark, characteristic, or distinguishing feature. In the past, it was actually this subsection that was used by the court to order the taking of a DNA sample, a blood sample. DNA was read into by the court of mark, characteristic, or distinguishing feature. This section is also used to read in taking of voice samples, and these samples can be taken involuntary and the court has found it to be constitutional. Then subsection B, order that steps including the taking of an intimate sample be taken which such court may be necessary in order to ascertain the state of health of any accused at such proceedings. This may be the instance where the accused asks lawyer or counsel asks for a postponement due to the health of the accused, and then the court thinks it may be employed to just delay proceedings can order that such attempt be taken, or in any other case where the state of health is relevant in the court proceedings. So this doesn't necessarily refer to DNA, it could be any condition. Subsection 4, any court which has convicted any person of any offence or which has concluded a preparatory examination against any person on any charge or any magistrate may order that the fingerprint, body print, a photographic image, a non-intimate sample, or an intimate sample of the person concerned be taken. So in the past this was a May provision, and it, yes, in the past this was a provision that dealt with convicted persons. Then subsection 5 is the one we are removing from the legislation. It used to be the section that said that if prints, all the prints, photographs, record of such steps taken would have been the DNA sample, DNA profile, had to be destroyed if the person concerned is found not guilty at a trial, or if his conviction is set aside by a superior court, or if he's discharged at a preparatory examination, or if no criminal proceedings with reference to which prints or photographs were taken, or record of such proceedings was made or instituted against the person concerned at any court, or if the prosecution declined to prosecute such a person. We're now saying we want a new subsection 5, which should read any fingerprints, body prints, photographic images, non-intimate samples, intimate samples, or the information derived from samples taken under any power conferred by this section may be the subject of speculative search. That would be a search we referred to previously. And then secondly is subsection 6A, then the new section where we're saying we want to retain these samples after it has fulfilled the purposes for which it was taken or analyzed, but it shall only be used for the legitimate government purposes repeatedly stated in this bill, which are the detection of crime, investigation of an offense, or the conduct of a prosecution. Then subparagraph 6B, any person who uses it's the same provisions then that follow again, it's saying that it's an offense to use it for any other purpose. It says that prints and photographic images must be handed over to the division CRC if it is in the police. Subsection D says that it's DNA profiles must be stored on the NDDSA. Those are standard provisions that are repeated throughout the bill where evidence is taken just to ensure that it goes in the right direction and that it's not used for any purposes outside the lawful purposes taken in this bill. Subsection 7, this is again the provision that allows that division to check for previous criminal records or to check if a person wants to apply for specific employment, whether it's got a previous criminal record. It just ensures that they're not criminalized when they do this check. And then subsection 8 is again the section inserted by the state law advisors, which we would like to amend it by this committee. Then if we move on to clause 4. Clause 4 deals with the amendment of Section 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Section 212 deals with the proof of evidence by affidavit or certificate in court. So this is the situation where you've got the expert witness and you don't necessarily need the presence of that person in court, but our courts have the practice of always calling them in any case. But in the affidavit, you would set out all the steps taken if it's fingerprints that was taken, who took it, and how the match was dealt, or specifically then if it was a DNA sample, it would be the certificate setting out all the details with regard to the analyst that performed the procedure. So here we're just making consequential amendments since we've now
inserted new definitions into Chapter 3 of the Criminal Procedure Act. We have to refer to those new definitions as defined under Chapter 3. And we've inserted the word bodily substance to ensure that DNA collected, that in future DNA will be collected on crime scenes, and any bodily substance found there can then be the form the basis for this provision as well. And I just know all of these are basically consequential. I mean, Chair, I don't know if you want me to go through this section word by word, because it's an existing law that we're just inserting.
Can you just summarize them easier on the way you did it?
Subsection 6 is the affidavit. The document purporting to be an affidavit made by a person who in that affidavit alleges that he or she is in the service of the state, that he or she performs in the performance of their official duties, they found the fingerprint, so it would be the certificate by the detective stating that they found the fingerprint or at such place or in the article in possession thereof, and how they dealt with the fingerprint, how the forensic science or the Division CRC Forensic Science Services dealt with it. And upon the mere production of such an affidavit in court, it shall be prima facie proof that such fingerprint or body print or any of the substances was so found, or as the case may be, was so dealt with. So this would be the chain of custody of the prints or the sample found at the crime scene. Subsection 8 then deals with the procedures as to the receipt, custody, packing, marking, delivery, or dispatch of any prints, body prints, article of clothing, specimen, tissue, or now it would be the sample. It would be those forms that the police have referred to when we were in the laboratories, where they set out step by step how who received the sample, who dealt with it, whether the machine was calibrated. All of that would be set out in this document. And then once again it says that shall upon the mere production thereof of such proceedings be prima facie proof, and then this matter will be further argued in court if the counsel for the defense, for the accused, challenges any of this. And then if we can then move on to section 225. Section 225 is a section that has been misunderstood if I read a lot of submissions. This is once again the existing position in law. All I've done here is made some additional consequential amendments by adding in the new definitions as referred to in Chapter 3. But subsection 1 specifically deals with the use of such evidence in a court, and it says whenever it's relevant to criminal proceedings to ascertain whether any fingerprint, body print, intimate sample, non-intimate sample, or the information derived from such sample taken, as defined under Chapter 3 of an accused in such proceeding corresponds to any fingerprint, body print, intimate sample, non-intimate sample, bodily substance, or the information derived from such samples or bodily substance, or whether the body of such a person has a marked characteristic distinguishing feature or shows or showed any condition or appearance, evidence of the fingerprints, body prints, or body prints of the accused, or that the body of the accused has any marked characteristic or distinguishing feature or showed any condition or appearance, including evidence as to the results of a blood test or DNA analysis of those samples, shall be admissible as such proceedings. So it deals with the admissibility of this specifically after you've done the speculative search, for instance, and you found the prints or the sample, or you found the prints or the body substance on the crime scene. Now you've run it against your database and you found the suspect, and then you've checked that it's the correct suspect through the normal investigation procedures by retaking the prints, retaking an intimate sample, being sure that it is your suspect, and then you want to present this evidence in court. This is the subsection that allows you to do so. Then subsection 2 is actually the section that was misunderstood, I think, by some of the commentators. This is, again, the existing position in law. We've just added in the new definition. This has been found constitutional on both issues here. There are two issues being dealt with in this subsection. The one is the admissibility of evidence that was not obtained in accordance with the provisions of section 36B, 36C, or 37. Once we go through the submissions, I will deal with the case law on this position with the committee. The position is that we've got section 51C of the Constitution that deals with the admissibility of evidence obtained in a manner not in accordance with the law, but it's for the court in the end of the day on a case-by-case basis to weigh this evidence, and especially in the case of real evidence, we've got case law that refers to the Canadian position, and that seems to be the position endorsed by our courts, where if it's real evidence that such as your fingerprints or a DNA profile, there's no real dispute. It existed before it was taken by the police. So usually the courts, even if it was then taken in a manner that might have been not admissible or might not be the prescribed procedure, the courts will allow it. But even if they now order the retake of it in court, it will prove the same fact. So it's that kind of reasoning, but the courts, our courts have specific jurisprudence. They've laid it down in judgment on this position. Then the second issue dealt with in subsection 2, which is again an issue some commentators said we're not addressing in the bill. They wanted to see other states, but they didn't see it, but they object to it or something to that effect. Is the fact that if you do not want to subject yourself to the taking of your prints or samples, then it can be taken against the wish or the will of the person concerned. This again is established principle in the existing Criminal Procedure Act. It's a part of our criminal law. It has been found to be in the interest of the administration of justice by our courts, Supreme Court of Appeal as well. You will never get an accused easily to submit himself to the taking of such evidence, and therefore it can be taken against his or her wish. Again, there's a lot of international case law on this position as well, but it's been challenged in the past, but it's been successfully decided part of law enforcement. Then if we come to the insertion of chapters 5A and 5B in the Stats Act, so now, Chair, until there, the clause deal with amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act, either inserting new clause, new sections, or amending the existing position by adding in words. Now we come to the Stats Act, and here what we're doing, we're inserting a chapter 5A to deal with the prints you collected. So everything you could, the power to collect these prints, photographs, and everything is dealt with under the Criminal Procedure Act. But once you've collected it, as we've now stipulated in the Criminal Procedure Act, you must hand them over to the police. And then they must go into these databases, and this is now where we start saying, how can they be maintained, administered, how should they be used? So the first chapter deals with the prints, body prints, photographic images, and the second chapter then is the important chapter where we establish the DNA database for South Africa. So if I start out, section 15A deals then with the storage and use of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images, and here it states that the National Commissioner or his or her delegate. Here I can just add that we've used it maybe again to the SAC comments of Acting Divisional Commissioner Haldenheid. He said that in the SAC Act it's not necessary for us to say or his or her delegate. In the CPA we can say it, but in the SAC Act there's a specific provision, as you would know, Chair, the legislation you've been involved with, that delegates powers, that the National Commissioner can delegate his powers, and it's specifically, so we're just going to delete that wording to be in line with the existing provisions of the SAPS Act. The National Commissioner must ensure that fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images taken under section 36B1A, that is now the where the police must take the fingerprints, then section 36.1, that's the provision where the police can take it for those investigative purposes, or section 37, that's the existing provision where they may take it as part of their investigation. So we're saying those prints must be stored, maintained, administered, and readily available, whether in computerized or other form, and shall be located within that division of the South African Police Service. Section 113 of the Firearms Control Act also deals with the taking of prints, as well as Section 9 of the Explosives Act, to which we've made consequential amendments later on in the bill. And then we've also said any order of the Department of Correctional Services. In my research document that I've provided to this committee, the Department of Correctional Services takes prints at the moment, but everything they take they immediately hand over to that division within the police. So we've added it in there because they've got a specific order in terms of which they take these prints. So this is just to capture all these prints, especially also we've mentioned here the Firearms and Explosives Act by name. We've looked at all legislation where prints are taken, because in the past the police, these two databases were actually never used for criminal investigation purposes. And it makes actually no sense, because it's prints taken from people who get a permit to carry a weapon, and and then we can't run their print. So we've included them there. Then 15A subsection 2, the National Commissioner must ensure that these prints, this section is specifically included in reference to the National Register of Sex Offenders that's being established under the Sexual Offences Act of 2007 that was passed by the Justice Portfolio Committee. And it's just to ensure that fingerprints, photographic images of persons' names must be entered into the register are taken and dealt with in accordance with subsection 1, so that we've got a database of their prints and photographs. We've inserted a similar provision in reference to that National Sex Offenders Register on the DNA side as well. We've just mentioned that from the police had here a request that it might just be very burdensome for them to say whose names must be included. So we said that we could look at the words whose names are entered. So as the police find, because they have to implement this legislation or this provision retrospectively, but so we were saying as they enter somebody, they must make sure that they take these prints and the DNA. So we might present that alternate wording to the committee. Then subsection 3 is just to it's just a provision to make sure that all the prints and photographs already stored by this division will be included in this in these databases, so that we do not lose any data. So it's a transitional provision. Subsection 4 once again only states that all of this evidence may only be used for these legitimate government purposes that I've mentioned previously, that the whole framework of this legislation is aimed at. Subsection 5 again makes provision for this division to run prints for the purposes of establishing whether a person has a previous conviction. And subsection 6 then criminalizes any conduct that goes without these specific parameters that are set out in subsections 4 and 5. Then section 15B deals with the speculative search against other databases. Here we refer them to the fingerprint databases of Harness, of Home Affairs and Transport. So it's a provision, an empowering provision to allow such searches to be run. And then again, if it's run for any purposes outside the specific government purpose behind this legislation of as referred to in subsection 1, then it's an offence. And then section 15C deals then with national instructions relating to the collection, storage, maintenance, administration and use of fingerprints, body prints and photographic images. We've provided here the National Commissioner must, in consultation with the Minister, issue national instructions regarding all matters. Again, after discussions with Divisional Commissioner Haldenite, they would like the police that wording of in consultation with the Minister to be removed. We also not had that in our original draft. I think it came in through the discussions with the State Law Advisors who wanted some specific consultations to be written into the section. But so that's just something I'm mentioning to the committee, because nowhere else in the statute legislation does the National Commissioner have to make national instructions in consultation with the Minister. The National Commissioner must issue national instructions regarding all matters which are reasonably necessary or expedient to be provided for in relation to this chapter, and which must be followed by all police officials, including the following: the collection of fingerprints, body prints, and the taking of photographic images. So these would be national instructions as to how to take. Then national instructions as to how to store, maintain, administer these prints, body prints, photographic images, the use of the information made available in terms of this chapter. So this would be as to how will you run the speculative search in 15B, and the manner in which statistics must be kept by this division in relation to all information collected, stored, and analyzed, which shall include the recording and maintaining of statistics of all exhibits collected at crime scenes. This was one aspect that came up through the review of the criminal justice system. We're trying, as one of the 7-point plan, one of the key areas within the 7-point plan of the review of the criminal justice system is to start using statistics in government to its full effect. And we've identified certain lacunas, such as we do not know at this stage what the police are collecting at crime scenes. They've never in the past really were required to keep. They kept statistics of fingerprints and whatnot, other exhibits found at crime scenes. So it's trying to look at how can we use statistics within the criminal justice system. Some of most of these national instructions, I presume, would have already exist in any case, because police have been collecting these prints, etc. It's just to emphasize the fact and that we're sure that they do it, that they are drawn up. In subsection 2, the National Commissioner must develop training courses in reference to these national instructions referred to in subsection 1. This is, for instance, where the training would have to be conducted as to how these prints are to be collected, how the stats must be stored, so if there's any, so to ensure that training takes place. Then subsection 3, the police official commanding the Division of Criminal Records Forensic Science Services within the South African Police Service is responsible for, in the subsection, subparagraph A, the development, implementation, and maintenance of a personal identification services strategy to give effect to the provisions of chapter of this chapter and chapter 5B, which is one dealing with DNA, and the development, implementation, and maintenance of systems and processes, including the required information technology infrastructure and systems to support such a strategy. This subsection was specifically inserted to ensure that this division has control over these processes. It doesn't help that we give them all these tasks set out or all the responsibilities set out in this legislation, and they do not have control over the information technology they might require. There's a lot of loopholes in government to jump through to work through different divisions, even within one department. And we're just trying to say, if it's this division that has all these responsibilities, we would like them to see to be in control of the development of all the infrastructure that they might need to implement this legislation successfully. And the personal identification services strategy just refers to the standardization across the police, and maybe then also even with reference to correctional services, wherever we deal with personal identification in the criminal justice system, how should photographs be taken, how should prints be taken, how should body prints be taken, stored, so that we've got one way of doing it and not five different strategies within the criminal justice system. That is a problem at the moment. Then Chapter 5B, which is the chapter dealing with the establishment, administration, and maintenance of a national DNA database for South Africa. This is then the chapter that deals in detail with the DNA database. Again, we've got, firstly, in 15D, definitions section, interpretation clause. These definitions are to a large extent exactly the same as we've dealt with in the Criminal Procedure Act. So we've got authorized person, firstly, but authorized person in terms of this chapter just deals with the police officer commanding the division CRC and FSS within the SAP or his or her delegate. So this is to limit access and the maintenance. Everything that has to do with the DNA database would be situated within this one division of the South African Police Service, where you have the forensic expertise and where it should be located, as we'll see later on in the bill. Then again, definition of child, Criminal Procedure Act, which is self-explanatory, DNA, again the same definition, DNA analysis we've dealt with. Then we've got here a definition of DNA profile, means the result of forensic DNA analysis of an intimate sample, a non-intimate sample, or any other bodily substance. The committee at this stage, I think, have a very good understanding of what the DNA profile is, so I wouldn't go into that in too much detail. Then we're just referring to the Explosives Act, the Firearms Control Act. Then intimate sample, again the same definition as in the CPA. Then we've got the NDDSA, which is the national database, the non-intimate sample definition. And then a new definition is volunteer. Volunteer means a person who freely gives his or her informed consent to the taking of an intimate sample or a non-intimate sample in accordance with Section 15J. And we will come to Section 15J, that's the section that deals with the volunteer index. And then for the purposes of this chapter, unless the context indicates otherwise, any reference to a person includes a child. Maybe I can just here clarify, I know Honourable Member from asked specific questions around children and the impact of this bill on children, and with reference to what the volunteer index is. Basically, the intent behind the drafting of this bill is that everywhere we wanted children to be included. So we've got the same, there's no distinction, it's not in any manner criminalizing anybody or invading such a person's privacy to keep the DNA profile or to keep the fingerprints on a database where it will only come up if there's a hit with a crime scene. So we're saying with children it would be the same. If the child came into contact with the law below the age of 18, we've taken his sample, we've taken his prints, we've loaded it onto the database, we will keep it there and it will have no impact on that child's life or on his ability to go study or do any work. It will only come up again in an investigation if there's a hit with a crime scene, and then the normal investigation will kick in, and such a child would be presumed innocent until proven guilty if that child had any connection with a specific crime scene. But there's no way where a reference check will be done or anything that this will jump up. It's the same as with adults. It will only come into play if there's a link with a crime scene. And then what then might have confused members was the reference to children in the volunteer index. That's actually where Ngofem Vaith raised the question. She said, but why then in the volunteer index do we say we agree with the statal advisors that if the child reaches majority, he or she can apply to have this data removed unless he or she was convicted by a court of law of an offence, then we would keep it in any case. But that would be the instance where if the parent of the child or the guardian of the child who's agreed to the, who's given informed consent, takes the sample, load it on. Now the child has no part in that. So now the child years later wants, or at the age of majority wants to remove it. We've got no problem with that. That's different than the situation where child came into contact with the law as part of an offence, an investigation of a suspect or... So that's why it's just important to distinguish between children in that sense. Then section 15E deals with the purpose of this chapter. This is just really a section that states the purpose and what government would like to achieve with this legislation. The purpose of this chapter is to establish and maintain a national DNA database which may be used only for the only for the purposes related to the identification of missing persons, identification of unidentified human remains, the detection of crime, the investigation of offence, or the conduct of a prosecution. Now, I should mention that the last three aspects have been mentioned throughout in the Criminal Procedure Amendment, but we would also like to include now reference, it was an oversight on our part, to missing persons and unidentified human remains in the CPA section. So it doesn't help, we allow the police here where they have the database to do the test, but we don't give them the power to actually take samples under the CPA for these specific legitimate purposes. So that would just be a consequential amendment throughout the whole bill. We would, for the purposes to, amongst others, serve as a, and should be, crime intelligence tool in the fight against crime, identify persons alleged to have committed offences, including those committed before the coming into operation of this law, where applicable, prove the innocence or guilt of accused persons, or where applicable, identify missing persons or unidentified human remains. Then, on the establishment of a DNA database, section 15F states merely that they are hereby established this database to be known as the National DNA Database of South Africa, NDDSA. The NDDSA, whether in computerized or other form, shall be administered and maintained by the National Commissioner and shall be located within that specific division within the South African Police Services. The NDDSA shall consist of the following five indices: crime scene index, which we'll deal with now, reference index, convicted offenders index, volunteer index, and then a personnel, contractor, and supplier elimination index, to be used only in the investigative repository or for DNA analysis. We'll deal with that index just now in more detail as well. Then again, just a general provision to say that, of course, we know that our forensic services at the moment have a very limited DNA database. So this subsection 4 just ensures that what we've got on there at the moment will be transferred to the database that will be established. So it would be the crime scene profiles that they've got at the moment where they could never make a hit before, and a few suspects they had on there. Crime scene index, then, the section that specifically deals with this index is 15G. The crime scene index shall contain DNA profiles derived by means of DNA analysis from bodily substances that are found. This is specifically where we refer to bodily substances. We don't put a definition in here because we want to leave it as broad as possible. In the CPA, there's also references to specimen or tissue without any specific definition. So it would allow the police to collect whatever they can find on a crime scene. this would not never be taken from a person, it's what you find on the crime scene. At any place where an offence was or was reasonably suspected of having been committed on or within the body of the victim or a person reasonably suspected of being a victim of an offence, on anything worn or carried by the victim at the time when an offence was or is reasonably suspected of having been committed, or on or within the body of any person or thing or at any place associated with the commission of an offence. It's just trying to cover everything that could have DNA evidence that could be found at any crime scene. Subsection 2, in addition to the DNA profile referred to in subsection 1, the database shall contain in relation to each profile the following information. Firstly, the case number of the investigation associated with the body substance from which the profile was derived. Here we've got a case number. None of the other industries would be have a case number except in the convicted offender index, which would be the docket reference to the conviction. But here you've got a case number because there was an investigation, a crime scene, but you might not have any suspect at the moment. Where applicable in the case number or any other investigation associated with the same DNA profile on the crime scene index. So it's again where you've got various crime scene indexes that you can see there's the same profile, but you still have no suspect. You've not loaded anybody that you found a hit with. So you want to at least, whoever 10 years down the line finds a suspect that hits, that makes a link with one crime scene, you'll see, but this person's DNA has also been linked with these other crime scenes. So it's just trying to build that investigative capacity. Where applicable and scientifically possible, the bodily substance used to derive the profile from. This body substance, of course, importantly, will always be kept. This is not the same as to be confused with the sample you take from a person arrested, because this is what you find on the crime scene, and then if you find somebody years down the line, you might want to retest that exhibit. So you will always keep this body substance. Then subsection 3, we will still make the recommendation to the commission, but that word forensic before DNA analysis should have just have been deleted because there is a definition for DNA analysis. Says DNA analysis of bodily substances stored may be performed if an authorized person, and now we know authorized person is only people working within that section of the police, as per the definition, is of the opinion that the analysis justified due to significant, that bodily substances stored. That you can repeat an analysis years down the line. This is what this provision makes, we try to provide for here. And then subsection 4 says, that just provides you can retake for these substances if the first take was not sufficient. And then we've got the reference index. The reference index is then dealt with in section 15.8 and shall contain DNA profiles derived by means of DNA analysis from an intimate sample or a non-intimate sample taken under any power conferred by chapter 3 of the CPA. So that would be the section 36B powers where it's compulsory to take the non-intimate sample, or then the section 36C powers where it's for the specific investigative reasons that the police can take a non-intimate sample when they've got reasonable grounds as set out in that section. Or then section 37, where the police may, as part of the investigation, or the medical practitioner, or the court may order. So it's all those instances that are covered here by reference to chapter 3 of the Criminal Procedure Act. The Firearms Control Act, or the Explosives Act, we will come to those provisions, but it's basically exactly the same wording as in section 36C, is where the investigative power tool, where there's reasonable grounds to suspect an offense. In addition to the DNA profiles referred to in subsection 1, the NADSA of on a reference index shall contain the following information: the identity of the person from whose body substance the profile was derived, and where applicable and scientifically possible, the intimate sample or the non-intimate sample used to derive the profile from. The subsection B will then fall away should the committee decide not to keep samples. But we will keep the identity, so that's literally all a reference index would have would be just the identity of the person. So this is where people, if they say that they've been found innocent, why are we keeping it? Literally, you're kept on this reference index. It's a code of numbers, and you will only come up in the future if you're linked to a crime scene, and then the normal investigation kicks in with all the safeguards we will come to later in deliberations as to what's built or how the procedure works in practice. literally it identifies the person by name. Then subsection 3, again, it allows for reanalysis of the stored samples, if we do store samples. And then subsection 4 allows the retaking of samples if it was not suitable for DNA analysis or insufficient in the first instance. Then the third type of index is the convicted offenders index, section 15I. Convicted offenders index shall contain DNA profiles derived by means of DNA analysis from intimate samples, non-intimate samples taken under any power conferred by, and those are the sections dealing with specific categories of convicted offenders that we will deal with in more detail when we deal with the submissions, where we've got some proof. But it's basically, this is where everybody that's been convicted of crime and the retrospective categories that we would like to apply to, and as I've said, this has been held to be constitutional in Canada, for instance. Or that were, and then secondly, of course, if you were inserted onto the reference index initially, and now you've been convicted, then you will move from the reference index to the convicted offender index. So this would be in future, because then your profile will, or your the database will, of course, have more information around you, because now it can say the case number or the docket number, any other information. Then subsection 2 deals with what will be kept on the database apart from the profile, would be the identity of the person, and then also the sample if the committee decides to take the sample. And then we've got the similar provisions again as in the first section. But in addition, we've got subsection 5 here, where, as we've done with fingerprints and photographs for the National Register for Sex Offenders, we're saying here, as the police populate this register, they must also take a DNA, they must also load the DNA profile of such person onto this index. Then a volunteer index. Volunteer index is used in other countries. They've used it very successfully in small towns where you've got a serial rapist and police go door to door and people volunteer their DNA. That's one example, or where you've got missing persons and a family member would volunteer their DNA to find the missing person in that kind of situation. But the volunteer index operates within specific confines. It says it's taken from an intimate or non-intimate sample from a person with his or her informed consent. If the volunteer is a child, this is where the child issue comes in that I've referred to just now. Sample may only be taken for the purposes of paragraph A with informed consent of the child's parent or guardian. Any police official may take a non-intimate sample for the purposes related to paragraph A, but an intimate sample may only be taken by a registered medical practitioner or nurse. It's the situation under the CPA as well that we've created for. And then subsection 2 is the important subsection here that deals with what is informed consent for the purposes of this clause. For the purposes of this section, informed consent means that the volunteer consents in writing to the taking of an intimate or non-intimate sample after a police official has informed him or her of the following: the way in which the sample or non-intimate sample will be taken, that the volunteer is under no obligation to give such a sample, that the sample of the DNA profile derived from it may produce evidence that might be used in a court of law, that the consent given under this section cannot be withdrawn. This is the situation with voluntary indexes in Australia, some of the staff in Australia, for instance, and in some of the states in the USA. It's not the situation in the UK, and that's actually interestingly what the Marker judgment then turned up. They said, well, you're keeping all other so-called innocents on your reference index, but somebody who volunteers can ask for it to be removed, so you're not treating everybody as if you're keeping everything, so you're actually discriminating. So we're not doing that, we're keeping everything once you've given the informed consent. Essential part thereof is that it will not be withdrawn. And that the sample taken under this section, the DNA profile derived from it, or any other information obtained of such sample will be retained in the database together with the identity of the person in accordance with how it's stored in terms of this chapter. And that the sample taken under this section, the DNA profile derived from it, any other information stored within or associated with the NDSA may only be used then again for those specific purposes, and there of course we will add in the missing persons and unidentified human remains. In addition to the DNA profile, subsection 3 provides that the identity of the person from whose bodily substance the profile was derived will be kept there,
and where applicable scientific responsible sample should be committed in scientific example. Then subsection 4 is again just the reanalysis subsection. Subsection 5 allows for the retaking again. And then subsection 6 is the section inserted by the psycho advisors with which we agree. Is that notwithstanding subsection 2D is the one where you can indefinitely keep a voluntary sample, a child, unless found guilty by a court of law, may upon reaching majority apply to the court to have either of her consent contemplated that subsection withdrawn, and then either her protocol will be deleted. Then the last index of the 5 indexes is the personnel, contractor, and supplier elimination index. This index is part of the quality control mechanisms that are used when you have a DNA database to eliminate any contamination. It's no use if you analyze a droplet of blood if you know it might have mixed with the investigators, or you should have started to eliminate that from the. Here I must just mention that the police would want us to ensure that this reads, and we thought we could do it by making references in subsection A and B, present tense instead of the have contaminated past tense, but we will still look at it furthermore with them. The intention is just to ensure that they can take these samples before the crime scene or before they might contaminate. They said a way it reads to them now, it might seem that you can only take it after this person might have contaminated. So the idea with the elimination index is to have it there ready beforehand. So we must just ensure, we thought it was okay, but we will just look at the wording again to ensure that this index will work in practice. But so basically it's taken from a police official who might have been on the crime scene, a police official who might do official duties in the forensic lab have come into contact with the sample, or any person involved in the manufacturing of any of the utensils, equipment, reagents used in this process, or any person responsible for the maintenance of the DNA equipment. Immediately the question might arise, but what happens if this person himself or herself might be part of the investigation if they're the suspect? That's why we added in subsection 4, which states that nothing in this section shall prohibit the taking of an intimate or a non-intimate sample from any person mentioned under subsection 1 in terms of chapter 3 of the CPA. So if you're a suspect, or if you're any one of those 5 or 6 categories under chapter 3 of the CPA, so if you're on the wrong side of the law, this does not prohibit the taking of your sample without your, because you will see it, for the purposes of this index, it must be taken with the voluntary consent of those police officials. But if you're part of an investigation, we will take it and it will be the normal procedure. So it does not ensure that these people cannot be investigated as such. Then the speculative DNA search and communication of information. Again, this is part of the safeguards. Only who can search on the DNA database, who can it be communicated to, and what circumstances or for what purposes. So it reads the National Commissioner or an authorized person, which would then be this division, shall compare any DNA profile that is entered in crime scene index, reference index, convicted offenders index, or the volunteer index of those DNA profiles that are already contained in the database, and may then, for the purposes related to, and then so clearly stated purposes, but you will see there we must only state 3 because we deal with missing persons and unidentified human remains in subsection 3 and 4. So for those purposes, it may be searched, and then they may communicate the following information. If the DNA profile is not already contained in the database, the fact that it is not. Or if the profile is already in the database, all the information contained in the database in relation to such a profile, which would then be the specific as contained per index. So one index might have a case number, a CAS number, and the other might just have the identity of the person. Then subsection 2, to whom may such information be communicated? For the specific purposes of the conduct of prosecution, investigation of offence, or detection of crime, would be to the police official, the prosecutor if he or she requests, judge if it's the court that orders the speculated search, a magistrate, a court, or then for criminal defence purposes, an accused person, or where the accused is a child, be either a parent or guardian, or his or her legal representative. And then subsection 3 states that nothing in this chapter shall prohibit the National Commissioner from as the missing, conducting investigations for missing persons, or that you can check against the database to identify unidentified human remains. Then subsection 15M deals with foreign law enforcement agencies. Here we have to distinguish...
Can we, before we start with the foreign law enforcement agencies, I think you've taken us through up to 15K, isn't it?
15L.
Yes, that's right. 15L, yeah. 15L. I think now, I just before we break for tea, I think this is a very long piece of legislation. I'll have to give to members now, before we sleep, give to members just to ask some of the questions that they think they need to ask up to here. And then if time allows us, we'll go further. But if not, tomorrow we'll start here and then we'll go further. In order for us to understand exactly what is it that you are talking about. Remember, this is open to you then from the page where she started to ask for certain questions, not forgetting the submissions that we had from some of the presenters, because most of the issues that they came across now are issues of concern that have been raised by the stakeholders. So I think now that they are here as the drafters and everything, we need to try and get some clarity and before we deliberate on our own, while they will not be part of us, we'll decide on this. It's open now for discussion from the service members. Ms. Johnson?
Yeah, thanks, Karen. I know we're going to get to the comments, but just on the definitions, you'll see the CTE raised some issues that there are sometimes, particularly in sexual offences, where you need to take swabs sort of from, not only from a person's mouth. Now, I mean, an intimate sample can only be blood, and then a non-intimate sample can only be those five things that are listed. But if you have to then take swabs from other bodily orifices, what would it be, and who would then take it? Or does it not apply, because those people would then be victims rather than accused? I mean, that's the only thing, but then I don't know why the CTE is raising it. Thanks, Chief.
Is there any other person? None. I have just a few here that I've started for clarity. 36B. One under a police official must. I just want a clarity. Must take the fingerprints or must cause such things to be taken. Must cause them to be taken. I need a clarity that if they are not taking those, who is the next person who can do that? If it's medical, then they must specify that medical people. If it's a certain person, they must say which person must do that. And also, under his or her delivery, you know, yeah. I also need clarity there. If we say that National Commissioner of South African Police Services or his or her delivery, that his or her delivery, that's one of the concerns that was raised by some of the presenters and also you did try and address some of the concerns. You did even indicate that about the keeping of the profile visas, the analysis. Yeah. Yeah, and I have a few here, but you can respond on this while I'm just going through the others.
Thank you, Chair. If I can start with the Commission on Gender Equality, I've looked at their submission, and the thing is that the CPA deals with accused and convicted persons. Victims volunteer anything to a medical practitioner, it will only be taken by me, and it will be whatever procedure the medical practitioner will be taking. So Chapter 3 of the CPA is never applied to victims. That's just not a victim. You cannot force the victim to submit to something, so it would be volunteered. So CGE misdirected themselves there. Then the cause to be taken, Chair, that was raised by one of the commentators specifically, and I know which commentator you're referring to. They were afraid that that might mean that we're referring to outsourcing or to some other person than a police officer.
this language comes word for word from the existing position in the Criminal Procedure Act, wherever we refer to something, a power of the police official, or it would mean that it's the police official on the crime scene who calls another police official to come and take a print, because he's not the expert. So he must, it's a police official who must cause the print to be taken. So he will call somebody who's been trained to take fingerprints from the person, or so it would always be a police official. There's no way it could be interpreted as outsourcing. The same with his or her delegate, the national commissioner. As I've explained, in the SACS Act, there's a specific section in this, I think it's 25, section 25, but I will bring the SACS Act with me next time, and where it states to whom the national commissioner can delegate his powers, and it's only a police official. You cannot delegate powers outside of government, never, so it cannot be outsourcing at all.
Thank you. And on because I didn't see it off. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me take Fatima first and then I'll come.
Just a bit of a follow-up, because I do think that there are times when the responses we're getting is that it must be somebody who can take fingerprints, for example. It's not just every police official who can possibly do that, or just do it and so on. And then there's some instances where we say, well, the authorized person has to be from the criminal investigation unit or what the crime. I'm not sure what that unit is called, to be honest, it's a long name. But it seems to me that in those clauses, we can actually narrow the scope of that clause in that sense. So you could, for example, and I'm not suggesting that we do it by rote, you know, every clause that you've got that phrase. But where it can be done, surely we should do that. Because I've also been very worried that when we say any police official can come onto the crime scene, well, in the legislation we talk about any police official can take a sample from a crime scene. But actually what we mean is these people, and not necessarily just any police official. And so I think that there is some scope as we go through the clauses in some instances to kind of try and narrow who we mean when we say any police official. But I mean, I think we can leave that for clause, you know, clause by clause kind of examination.
And is there any other hand? Dr. Madasa and Dr. Julie?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm not sure about this last comment. If there's a restriction of who lifts up this evidence at the crime scene, will the people who are then to whom the restriction applies be able to reach all these crime scenes? I don't know if that is practical. I'm concerned about that. The second thing is section 37, subsection 3, talk about the powers of the court. I don't know, maybe I'm a bit drowsy this moment. I actually don't follow what the bill is trying to do, what kind of powers it's trying to give to the court. I mean, in our system, we still have an adversarial system, the bill here seems to be giving some power to the court to do certain things, narrow more true, so to speak. I would have understood it if it was upon instigation by one party or something like that. So I just want to understand what are you trying to do in this provision? I don't follow it. How would the court, under what circumstances would the court feel that it must order certain things? And then 15H reference index. And I don't know, again, I need clarity. We seem to be doing two things. On one hand, we are authorizing storage of only the identification part of the semblance. On the other hand, we seem to be creating accommodation for the storage of the semblance itself, if such storage is justified. Now, I don't understand that, because we know that this is exactly where the controversy generated. Because we are given the impression that the identification part of the DNA is sufficient for the purpose of detection of crime and so on. Now you say maybe in future there might be other indications that this may be useful, the sample itself. I think that is going to create problems. I detect a self-contradiction there. Because this you do in 15H, what, 2B? No, what, 2B, yes. Just one clarity there. Yeah, stop there for now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman. I just want to find out one thing. You know, I listened to the comments, I think, that was flowing from honorable member Temaji. Now, when we talk of the people who must execute this, if we name them, like make a distinction, to me it cuts both ways. To say, if we name them, then the question that the honorable member is asking, is it adequate to execute, you know, to pay all these things and ever? Because when that happens, we didn't need to cut the working people on spot to take the samples, the necessary samples, or whatever kind that has been covered in the field. I'm looking at it practical. But then, again, if you don't name them, to what extent will it also be distinct, known to the ones who are the, you know, police station or police, whenever there's a problem, or any police, you know, saying, look, I want to help, but I'm not empowered. But the bill, the act, then says, no, any police, you know, if you haven't named the person that is taking up, if you haven't drawn a distinction. Then if any person does it, you know, will that person have again the same capability? Obviously not, because of there's a reason why you need to do some distinction. But when you do distinction, will they be adequate? So I'm asking this to me, social theorist chairperson, I'm more maybe following to your comment earlier on when you started, when you said you might need to have the police. The people, you know, because I can't craft the thing, but the people who are going to do it or that we investigate, it might be meaning something else to them. When you look at now the practicality. So I took note of your comment earlier on when you said perhaps they also have to speak for themselves on this matter. Because we're asking for something, it's like it's a small thing, but it can really mess up the whole case. Who had power to what, and the other one thought also he had power or he didn't have power, you know, that type of thing. So, and related matters, like those stories and so on and so forth. So I would indeed suggest, I think, we, as we are putting this, we align ourselves with your earlier comment that we also need police really to walk along with us on this part of our community.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mufuli. You made a comment on 15C. The National Commissioner must, in consultation with the Minister, you say that stuff we must delete in consultation with the Minister. I feel that we need to leave it there. In consultation, the Minister must be there. I feel that we need to. And must also specify that we are talking about the Minister of Safety and Security. Because this bill as it is now, it's referred to the Minister of Justice, but as ad hoc committee dealing with it. So where issues are being dealt with by the Minister of Safety and Security, it must say that safety and security, if it's
justice, it must also say that by the Minister of Justice. And also under 15K, it goes back to my initial concern of saying any other person. There's a lot of any other person there. I'm worried about this any other person. What kind of a person are we talking about? Hence has Madasa has also raised a concern about these persons who are not being named. I also raised a concern. But you must know that he said that when I started that, you know, most of these concerns were raised by Bukru and whatever. And you must not forget that Bukru are police officers, and they constituted more than 50% of the police who are supposed to implement this. So we must make sure that we take all the stakeholders on board, especially the police. Because that, at the end, we will pass this piece of legislation in Parliament. The problem will come when it comes to the implementation of this piece of legislation. I'm still saying that in the next 2 weeks, yes, I am going to call the management of the police. They must come and tell us whether, what is it that they have in place if we pass this legislation tomorrow that will convince us that they will be able to implement this. You know? And also the issue of training has been mentioned now. It's obvious that, as members has indicated, that on a crime scene, if something happens today, the first place where people are running to is the police station. If we then have people with that skill at the police station, how are we going to implement this piece of legislation? So those are some of the issues. We talk about practical things, when they happen on the ground, practical things. So the police must tell us, what is it that they have, that they think that they've got sufficient police officers who will be able to do this? Then we can pass this legislation. I'm very sorry to say that if we don't go through all this process that I mentioned here, there is no way that you can say within a day or two we're going to pass this legislation. We must be convinced that what we are passing here as Parliament, and take responsibility, that it will be able, the police will be able to implement them. So I ask all these things because I really need clarity on them, because when if we get questions from people who are supposed to implement this, then it becomes a problem. You must know how to deal with this as the lawmaker. Thank you, sister. For so far, I'll end there.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I'll start out by just mentioning that this legislation was drafted step by step with the police and then other stakeholders like the prosecutors and correctional services. And I'm going to hand over to the police just now, the divisional commissioner of the criminal record forensic science services who is here, superintendent from his from the lab, as well as the assistant commissioner for detectives with the investigation side. If I can just clarify around the crime scene and the collection, this bill does not deal with any powers of collection at a crime scene. Crime scene powers are dealt with in national orders and instructions. This bill only deals with the things you find in a crime scene once you present it in court with the affidavit or a certificate. But in practice, the police have their own standing orders as to who can collect at a crime scene. That is not that's never been regulated by the Criminal Procedure Act. So for a crime scene, it's only the crime scene investigators who have received the specialized training. Your first officer on the, but the police will elaborate on this, but the first officer to arrive in a crime scene will just secure the perimeter, put up a red ribbon. Then you'll wait for the crime scene investigator to arrive, who then gathers the samples. The only powers that this bill deals with, where we refer to specific police officials, or where we refer to any police official, is where we have those categories in 36B for the collection. And there, what might be a good idea is to say any police officials who've undergone the training, because we're going to provide for training detectives. And the police, in their standing orders, again, one of the safety mechanisms they're building in is they're saying that if you're the investigating officer on the crime scene and you're collecting under you have crime scene investigators collecting the evidence on the crime scene, you will not be the same person who will take a buckle swap from the arrest scene. That would be three or four people they're going to train in the police station for that area, and that person will take that sample, and then it's that whole process of chain of custody of putting it in that specific kit with the barcode. So the two processes are separate, but they're not. So what we might deal with in the legislation, if I can read members' concerns, is to say that that any police official should just be at a provisor to it saying who's undergone the train, who can do this. That's just on the crime scene. I don't know if the police want to add something before I
can. Can we break for tea, and then they can just add when we come in? So
just for 10 minutes. Outside the legitimate government purposes stated in this. So it won't be for to see the medical history or whatever. It would be specifically just to, just another method that might be easier to derive a DNA profile from, if scientifically possible. It's just some of the samples may be so small that if once analyzed, you can not keep it in any case. That's why we've put in that specific wording there. Then section 15C, where we refer to the minister, the distinction to make in this legislation is that the first two clauses deal with amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act. And in the Criminal Procedure Act, any reference to minister is the Minister of Justice, while this 15C, anything with a 15, come into the SAPS Act, and any reference in there falls under the SAPS original provisions or definitions, and it will always be the Minister of Safety and Security. So it's not necessary here to restate that. And then 50K, where we refer to any person, any place in this legislation where the term any person is used, it will always be within a specific context. So you have to read the whole clause. And there, if, even if it says any person, it would be any person who works with these specific reagents, for instance, that they use. But it would never be any person. It would always be within a context. So that should relay some of the fears of Bob Krubin. If I read their submission, it was specifically around outsourcing. And maybe just the divisional the commissioner could address this point at this stage, or I don't know if other management could come and address it, but the whole issue around outsourcing, basically all the submissions made by Bob Crew, the way I've summarized them as well, they will always come back to the point that they were really afraid that this process would be moving away from SAPS. And that's why maybe also when management comes, it would be necessary to recall the deputy minister who is heading the review of the criminal justice system and where this bill also emanated from. And when we went to cabinet, we specifically had to say, how are we going to implement this? And we specifically, the deputy minister went to the Mincombat in December last year, and Treasury has formed part of all deliberations around the bill. So there is an implementation plan over a five-year period, and it's been addressed clause by clause. Say the clause, say you take a finger prick, then it would say, but then we would need so many kits and so many. So there's a five-year budget. That's the billions that Pop Crew referred to in their bill. That's the implementation plan from part of the package, but that's not my area to address, I know. I'm just saying it might be some of the, when people come to address it, because in the review of the criminal justice system, there's specific task teams have been set up to look at expanding crime scene experts, expanding detective capacity, and it's all part of the 7-point plan. And the President, in his State of the Nation address on Friday, was specifically mentioned in his closing remarks the strengthening of forensic capacity within SAP. So it is a government priority, this book, and that's it.
Thank you, Susie. Is it a follow-up?
No.
Is there a new question? Okay, let me take Fatima first.
No.
Mine is a follow-up.
It's actually an intervention.
Okay.
No, Chairperson. You see, I'm sitting with my neighbor here who are arguing on something that I think the presenter was too fast in answering. I think, you see, here's a point to say the legislation, even if we want to strengthen what is there now, but there's a gap that he foresees, and is trying to draw the attention of the department to say, no, but this is the matter that usually becomes a problem. But now, you know, the presenter is outlining the usual way they do things. So we're calling for, if you can pause a bit, let him rerun his argument to say why lies this problem, because he's trying to sensitize us to that point, chapter 3. The Honorable Madam, what he was trying to do. But I could see, because we're agreeing here when you look at it, but I think we're missing each other with the presenter on what he's trying to draw our attention to.
Did you capture that? Yes, Chair, but I'm not clear on as to what exactly the problem is and what the proposal would be then from the Honourable Member as to how to address this, because we never looked at this section in that sense, so I'm just, maybe that's why I'm not answering his or relaying his worries on this specific issue. So maybe if you rephrase. Honourable Magasa.
Thank you very much. I have a very good legal representative here, who's made sure that I have the second part. Thank you very much. The point. No.
So that he can advise you accordingly.
I'm going back to that provision. That is the court's name. Now, you said there's enough law, you know, to indicate that the court can do that. All I was doing, Chairperson, is to anticipate challenges. I think it's important that as we do this exercise, we also anticipate challenges. And where we can show them, we do. If we can't, it's fine. I'm not really making this a big issue, but I was just highlighting to her that if it's not clear that the court may do this on its own, it's not indicated in the law, someone will challenge when the court is trying to do that, even though the court has done it before and there's case law that the court can do it. But I'm just saying someone may challenge and say, on what basis is the court doing that? And then the court says, no, in terms of section what? And that person says, no, but this section doesn't say that you can do it on your own. You know what I'm saying? So it's open to interpretation that the court may do it on its own. Yes, that's one interpretation. Another interpretation is that the court may do that, whatever order it wants to make, upon application by someone else. So I'm saying, as long as there's that possibility of more than one interpretation, if we can close that that gap, let's do so. But look, I don't want to engage some academic exercise with the presenter that is unending. I was just highlighting that point. That's it.
Yeah, I think when you highlight something that you foresee problems in future, you've got all the right to do that, so that the drafter should really look into that matter. That's what is supposed to happen. Honorable Fatima?
Mine was a follow-up. I think part of the difficulty that we have with this legislation as a whole is that while we're trying to introduce new systems, we're actually working on the back of an old system. And so there are many things that have preceded us in terms of practice, such as the directives that we heard about earlier, to, you know, who goes on the client team first and what that they are empowered to collect and what they're not, and so on. And I thought it would be very useful, if they are in existence, for us to have copies of those directives, because I think that would clarify a whole lot of issues for us, because one of the things that we have been concerned about is precisely that issue, Commissioner. The second thing that I wanted to just check was on this very clause relating to the court's powers, and I know that Dr. Lowe has said that we haven't changed that clause too much insofar as it is already in existence, and I guess that's why she responded as she did to the previous question, because the courts have interpreted this over many, many years, this particular clause, and so there was, you know, if we alter the thing just to include our definition of intimate and non-intimate and so on, then the courts don't really have much to reinterpret, if you with me. But I'm just worried that Section 36 does, you know, we've extended the powers of 36. And when you start the clause by saying in any case in which a police official is not empowered in terms of 36, then you're kind of closing the, you're shutting doors for the courts to be able to do these things. That's the way I'm reading this thing, as more of a limitation than an empowering provision for the courts. And I'm just wondering whether previously, because you know, police were just able to take, may take fingerprints, that kind of phraseology was used, whether this doesn't now give it completely a different meaning, because we've extended the powers of the police to that, to quite a significant extent, in that they must take fingerprints of every arrested person. So if they are empowered to do it, that means you're ousting the court, so to speak, from doing this, because the interpretation could be that because the police are empowered to take those fingerprints, the courts can't do it anymore. So I'm just worried about those consequences. Also, I think one of the issues arising during the public hearings, and I can't remember who raised it, I think it was the National Prosecuting Authority, where they were arguing for the extension of the definition of body prints to include things like voice samples and other things, iris prints and so on. And again, that's going to, and I think they even suggested a kind of an open-ended or any other body part or something like that. So again, that's going to play into a limitation, which we need to be very careful about if you're going to use the phrase any, you know, if in any case in which a police official is not empowered to give this power to the court.
Ms. Van Wyk?
Chairperson, Dr. Lowe referred to a document that and a five-year plan about the implementation. I think it would be good if we can get sight of it, of what they are willing to give us in any case. I'm not saying if there are things that they don't want us to see, they shouldn't do that. But, you know, I think it would be useful for us to see how they plan to implement this over 5 years. After all, we are the lawmakers. It's no use governors say it's okay. In the end, we've got to be comfortable that it is implementable, that we agree with the figures, that we agree with the plan, and also from our practical experience that we have, whether what is put on paper will actually work. So if we can get a copy of that document, I think it would be helpful.
Do you want to say something?
Yes, if I could just quickly respond to some of these issues. That document formed part of the package that the commissioner gave to members, because I found it in my package, the tabular format, but they will give it again. But then also, just as to this, whether it's limiting, the situation that might arise here, even though the police will be taking it under those circumstances, say now, for instance, it's challenged in court again on some level, then the police can't retake it. They don't have, once it's challenged in court, the power to retake it. Then it will be the court who would say, go retake those prints. So that's where I think it's been used in the past, because even though it said may in the past, the police did take a lot of fingerprints, but then there might have arisen a situation. So it's really for those situations where the court feels, so that's how I think it operates in practice. It's where the police had the power, but the police's power was only in the beginning, and now it's being challenged or something in court, and the court wants to reanalyze it, or it wasn't taken for some reason.
Just to say that, I mean, we've now included clauses that says that we can retake those prints, we can retake samples and so on. And my question is, assuming somebody's arrested, then given bail or whatever it is, and we didn't do adequate prints, the point of the matter is the police can still go and retake those samples even while the case is pending, it seems to me. That's how we've changed the clause to read. And that's why I'm worried that you're going to get arguments say, well, they've always got the power until the verdict is given, whether the person is guilty or not guilty and so on. They've always got the power to take those prints. And if they've always got the power, then the courts are out. And that's the only
and it may be that I'm wrong in that interpretation, because there may be something else in the Criminal Procedure Act that doesn't allow for it, because I haven't looked at that. So that's all I'm just alerting you to. So if it is somewhere in the Criminal Procedure Act that still allows the court and animal officer to do whatever. But then the other issue that Maiti Madasa raises is, I mean, I can't see why the court on application by any party can't do something of that sort. And again, this may be covered in the Criminal Procedure Act, but if this is the only clause, then it applies mero muto as far as the court is concerned. I'm not sure if there is a clause in the Criminal Procedure Act that says that the court can entertain an application by any person in the case, either the prosecution or the defense, to ascertain a certain mark. Because you may find that a witness says that for the first time in court that so-and-so had a scar, behind his neck or on his spine or something like that, and then the police wouldn't have had an opportunity to do that, and then the court should be able to do that. So, I mean, it seems to me that it should be something we should consider.
Thank you. Is there any other question from Annalise and Sis Maggie there? No, I think for today, we've come to the end of this meeting. And then we'll start then tomorrow morning at 9:30, continue with you taking us through the piece of legislation at V454 at 9:30. V454. 9:30, but Jeremy will send out the SMSs for tomorrow's meeting. Maybe I should also indicate that from the response from Assistant Commissioner De Toy, it is an evidence that this thing, it will be difficult to implement it if we pass this thing tomorrow, for instance. Yeah. And it is clear that I need to have a meeting with the Minister for Safety and Security and the senior management before we can pass this. And because of the issues that he raised, the implementation strategy or plan that he says they do have if this legislation gets passed tomorrow, we don't want to pass it then we start working on it. When we pass the legislation, we know that the police will immediately implement this. So at least we need to be told, as the ad hoc committee, that this is what we prepare. I'm sure that the police knew about this piece of legislation, because the presenter did indicate that when it was drafted, the police were part of this. So they knew that by this time we'll be dealing with this thing, at least they must have their infrastructure in place that will have to implement, including human resource. But I'm talking about the training of the police and all those. But when you go through this legislation, it's obvious that most of the things are only going to be done when we have passed this legislation. And that's not how we want it. At least we need to have a focus. We need to understand that if we pass it today, what will happen? Many issues have been raised, but I think that I don't want even to argue those things. Examples of if there is a house breaking, there is no need for experts and all those things. But when the police go to those scenes, they will say that you are going to get experts for you, don't touch this window, don't touch this door. And they come back after 10 days. If you keep on then asking for them, what happened? Because I want to close my window. You can't close the window. So somehow we have a problem. We have a problem, communication problem, or we don't understand what we are doing. So we need to get all those facts right before we can pass this piece of legislation. If there are some other legislations who tried to address this matter, let us rather strengthen those legislations instead of us coming with a new legislation every time we get across problems, we come up with new legislation. The legislation is good. You heard from presenters over here. Everybody is in favor of this legislation. But what use is it if everybody is in favor of the legislation and we pass the good legislation, but when it comes to implementation, we don't implement that? It's a bad image to the police, and I would like that to happen to members of SAPS as a chair of this committee. So I think somehow, in between the processes, I also need to meet with the police and the minister and all role players and the management of POPCO, of course, because they are the ones who are supposed to implement these things, the police, at the end of the day. So I think that But, you know, Jeremy, leave this program. It might change. This program might change. Depends on what we get from people. Depends from what we get now. We can't say that by Friday we'll report to Parliament. What is it that we'll report to Parliament whilst we're waiting for the department to tell us whether they are ready or not to implement this thing? So we can't. Everything will change now. This thing, we might even pass this thing when we come back. We might not pass it at all if we see that if there are some other legislations that we think that we need to strengthen it. Or if we're not convinced that there are some infrastructure which is in place, human power, police officers, do they understand what is expected from them? Instead of them going to crime scenes and say that we'll come back with experts and then they never came back. So those are some of the things that we needed to address before we pass it, if we still want to be considered as a powerful parliament. Thank you very much. We've come to the end of this session. We'll start tomorrow.